This is Cats Podcast, episode number 50. On today's show, I'm chatting with Ayla Cuenca, founder of Uncovering Birth, holistic birth guide, doula, and birth educator. I absolutely love her mission, which is in essence educating around birth, pregnancy, and postpartum, and helping us alchemize birth trauma so we can birth without fear and become the self-sovereign beings that we're actually meant to be. This episode is especially for you if you're trying to get pregnant, if you are pregnant and want to know more about your options on how and where to give birth. Spoiler, the hospital is not the only option. And what you can do to make pregnancy, birth and postpartum a smooth experience. And Ayla has one extremely empowering message for all of you lovely ladies listening who are beyond 35. It's not too late. Listen in and you'll know why. There's also a brand new free masterclass from Ayla on postpartum, which you can sign up for through the link in the show notes. Thanks so much for being here. And now enjoy our conversation. Welcome to the show, Ayla. Super happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Such a pleasure. So Ayla Cuenca, she's a childbirth educator, a doula, a health freedom activist, and a birth trauma alchemist. And you can add to that list because you're doing so many amazing things. But what you're doing really is you're helping people dive into the deeper stories and patterns that play a major role in what we believe in and how we act and how we lead our lives. So I'll stop here and hand it over to you if you like to introduce yourself a little further and also correct me if I understand everything the right way.
Sure. I've never actually considered myself an activist, but I can roll with that for sure. I've been doing birth work for a little over 10 years, attending births as a doula, which is like a physical and emotional support coach, let's say, to put it really simply. And shortly after attending births, I wanted to work more in education around birth, because what I saw is that women required multiple types of support, not just support at the moment of her birth, not just support with the breastfeeding and the postpartum afterwards, but there was a whole education component missing for young women or for women who were transitioning from, you know, girlhood to womanhood, not really understanding how to nourish themselves, how to prepare for this rite of passage, how to consciously communicate with their partners, husbands about the process, consciously conceive. So I saw that there was this kind of bigger picture. And as I went into the education around birth, I also started learning a lot of stories of women who had birth trauma, right? And who felt nervous about giving birth again, or felt that they never wanted to have more children because of the experience they had previously, or the experience that even their mother had with them. And so I really started to come into awareness about this web that comes from birth, the vehicle of birth, you know, and spreads out, and started to see a lot of patterning in women who, you know, in their own parenting journey as a mother, how experiences that they had in their birth with their baby impacted the way that they connected to their child. And so, yeah, this is where I started the birth trauma alchemy work. Bert Hellinger, who was a family systems therapist, he designed or coined what we now know to be family constellations therapy. And so I trained in that method and started applying those techniques to working with women, and were able to, I guess, unbraid and untangle a lot of the belief systems that we have about certain, the way that we think things are supposed to be versus the way that they, the way they can be, let's say. And so that's been a really powerful tool in alchemizing birth trauma, getting to the next level of what we want in our lives, receiving. A lot of women have blocks in receiving. And so when we do this work, when we look at the birth, when we look at what they want for their journey, we can use this method of family constellation therapy to get closer to that. So, yeah. Mm.
Thank you for this introduction. So, two things. So, first of all, two aspects of your work literally jumped at me or captured my attention immediately. And that was fertility and getting pregnant after 35 or 40. And that's something that we have been told and keep telling ourselves that this is, oh, it's super difficult, to get pregnant once you hit 35 or 40. So we'll dive into that. And the other aspect that I find really, really interesting, and I'm sure these two are entangled, is what has changed with birth in the last 150 years? And you made this post on Instagram about it. I was like, oh my God, this is so amazing. I want to talk about that with you. And now, looking at my series on women's health, like, okay, what's that got to do with health? Some of you might ask, like, just looking at, your physical body or so. I mean, in the background, the belief systems, the narratives that we have been told and that we keep on telling us, they manifest through us, within us, right? So we're a manifestation of what we believe. So diving into these narratives can really help us get better health on a physical level. And yeah, I guess that's it. That's all I want to say for now. So
That's it. 5 hours later. I know this is gonna be like a, I'm like, how much time do we have? Because yeah, that's a really important point. I think that we tend to gloss over, as human beings, that we actually have so much agency and so much self-sovereignty when it comes to this life that we're in. And that's, I really connected to the work of the cellular biologist, Dr. Bruce Lipton, about 6 years ago, because that's when I started seeing like women, men, and then children eventually in the birth space, coming out of the birth space, kind of create this life script, right? So Bert Hellinger talks about that. We create a life script the first 7 years. And so those beliefs that we begin to form just end up being the way in which life is perceived, and the way in which we receive and give, the way in which we manifest a career, we manifest a partner, all of these things, right? There's, of course, like the divine play that we're in, but also there's the inspired action that we take through our belief systems. And so when it came to birth, I started to see that women had these limiting beliefs underneath what they're saying they wanted. There was almost like a divided will, where it's like, well, I really want to have a natural birth, and I really, want it to be this way. I want to breastfeed. However, I know it's hard. Many women can't succeed at it. Birth is dangerous. Birth is painful. And this happened to my sister, or this happened to my friend. So they're saying they want something that they don't really believe in. And so a lot of the work was, when I work with women one-on-one or in my group classes, it's about working through the limiting beliefs. And it's challenging, because there's always this mechanism that's trying to keep us safe, right? That's trying to protect us from the unknown. And so it's like, well, it's better if I can't control, if I can't control this, I don't feel safe. So I just need to get more control. And sometimes these stories of the worst case scenario are the way that we have control, preparing ourselves for the worst. And so I started to see that women really were kind of designing and co-creating these horrific, sometimes horrific birth experiences, simply because they were not willing to let go of the belief systems that were in contradiction to what they were saying they wanted or desired. So, yeah, I really do believe that our environment impacts the way that our cells turn on and off, the way that we begin to, manifest physical ailments, all through belief systems, all through unresolved emotional conflict. And this is why resolving birth trauma or looking at our mother's experience when she was pregnant with us can inform us a lot about our current state of health, physical health and mental health, spiritual health. Yeah, so it's quite powerful when we start digging and digging, and trying to get to that core. It's like an onion, right? It's all the layers. Yeah.
So let's dive into the fertility and being able to get pregnant after 35 or 40 years of age. I find it so interesting because when I look at my circle of friends and acquaintances, women, so often I hear that people are trying to conceive, but they can't. And then they will go for some kind of fertility treatment, which often comes with a few rounds of trying and no success. And it just seems all so hard. And we also know that there's this fertility crisis, right? So, how did we get there? Where does this fertility crisis stem from?
Many, many places. The fertility crisis stems from many places. However, we can just try to isolate a few of the things that might be a little bit more manageable and within our control. So, first, our lifestyle has changed completely, right? We have moved out of tribal systems of community where we women, and I mean the entire community, women and men and children, had a type of support that made childbearing more easeful, more welcome, more realistic, right? Women would learn how to nourish their bodies as their rite of passage, right? So they would begin their first bleed. They would be taught by all the other women in the community on how to eat, how to do things, how to take care of themselves. They learned about birth from an early age because they were watching birth. And so then by the time they were, ready to have a family, they were prepared. And then after the birth, they had community support. We live in a very different time now where women have to pay for support to, either to a daycare or a nanny or, just hired help. So there's a lot of cost now associated with even having a child. Women have been fueled, and men, with stories that having children is complicated. So many childhood diseases and issues have been normalized. So people also expect that having a child is going to be quite burdensome and expensive. So energetically burdensome and expensive. And they don't often live near their family because we live in a super globalized community now where you can live across the earth and your family's in another part. And so you have to build your own community with strangers, basically, which are not typically people that you would leave your children with or receive support from during postpartum. And
But
so,
then again, sorry to jump in here, but then again, people give away their children to daycare when they're not even a year old, which I actually find quite awful in a way.
It is awful. It is quite awful for the child and unconsciously for the mother as well. I mean, I don't think that, I mean, many women I talk to don't get excited or have years of excitement, wanting to get pregnant to raise a family just to give their child away to, an 18-year-old on minimum wage when the child is only 6 months old. And that's pretty much what happens in the United States anyway. And so that alone, the lifestyle change, and I'm glossing over a lot of intricacies, but that's one of the main things. And then, of course, diet and nutrition. We have lost so much tradition when it comes to how to nourish ourselves. I mean, we live in a society where we can just walk out the front door and food is prepared for us. So many women, I would say like the last generation of women that were really cooking and knew how to cook from scratch and make wholesome foods, and meals with very few ingredients. I think that generation is probably two behind us at this point. Like women born after 1960, like for the most part on in general, don't have the same skill set when it comes to cooking and nourishing their family with food. So we're losing that. It's like a language. It only takes one generation to lose this vocabulary and this language of food and nourishment. Women in North America, for example, in Canada, are deeply malnourished. 60% of them are below where they're supposed to be when it comes to iron and B vitamins, B12, B6. HTP3. Their protein intake is incredibly low. Their fat intake is incredibly low. And when our fat intake is low, our hormones are not properly functioning. Therefore, women are having issues with thyroids, with their thyroid, with hormone production. Then they're needing to get synthetic hormone therapy. And then they're needing support with IVF, right? They start to go down that route. So women are deeply malnourished. And women might say, I feel fine. I look thin. I don't have any major health issues. However, they're not understanding that they are deeply malnourished. Women are supposed to be getting a minimum of 100 grams of animal protein per day. And we are recommended by national organizations in North America that 45 grams is enough. It's sufficient. However, women are deeply malnourished and not able to get pregnant. So when a woman is already depleted in this sense, she tries to get pregnant, the body is in a state of fight or flight because it's that mechanism where it's like, will I have food tomorrow? Which is something that exists within us, and it has since our inception. Especially, you know, we lived under a lot of stress when we were in the time of hunting and gathering. Our body knows this state as it's not safe to get pregnant and give birth. And so women are living in that state chronically on a daily basis. And so then if they do get pregnant, then they have a pregnancy that's often complicated because of the malnourishment. They're already deficient, but IVF overrides that very often. So mm-hmm. Now the woman is pregnant, but she is still malnourished. She gives birth from a deficient state, and then she's even more malnourished in her postpartum, can't breastfeed, gets postpartum depression, has to go back to work. There's so many factors that even when a woman finally does get pregnant, it's not easy. So the two main components I would say are those, if we're looking at a third, it's belief systems about a woman's body and its capacity, right? We look at mammalian studies of eggs in female animals, and we see that eggs are actually replenishing themselves, not at the rate that it was happening when they were younger, but they are still, it's like if you look like at a sieve or a funnel, right? And so it's like you can be pouring them in, but now they're coming in at a lesser degree with lesser frequency, but it's still coming in. And so women are producing new eggs. They don't run out. We don't have a reserve. And unfortunately, I mean, in my thinking, the reason that this has not been extensively studied and researched with humans is because there's an entire industry that benefits off of women not knowing that they actually can conceive in their 40s and 50s as long as they're menstruating, right? We've also been, you know, sold the story that we go through menopause when we're in our early 40s and that's it. Meanwhile, I know at least a dozen women in my personal life who are in their late 40s and early 50s still menstruating. My mother is in her late 60s still menstruating. And so for me, it's really about what we know about how we nourish our bodies and what we choose to believe. And it's difficult because we might listen to this and realize I've been choosing to believe a story that doesn't serve me. And it's really triggering and upsetting. But the good news is that you can decide to change that story. And so, yeah, I'd say those are the three main reasons that, that we have challenges, you know, getting pregnant. And we have a whole industry working toward the sale, the idea that at 30, you should start, if you're not married, if you haven't had a family yet, you should start freezing your eggs just in case, you know, your body becomes geriatric, right? Biologically geriatric, and you can't get pregnant when you're 34 or 35. At least you have some eggs frozen and, you know, they could be fertilized and implanted. And, you know, there's a whole, I've worked with so many women who froze their eggs in their early 30s and then got naturally pregnant in their late 30s. And now they have a bunch of either frozen eggs or embryos that have been fertilized, and now they don't know what to do. And they've been paying money to store them, and they feel emotionally, spiritually conflicted about throwing them away. Surprise, surprise, because it is life. And so they feel responsible for that life. And now what? So women are even going to the extent of doing compassionate miscarriage, which is actually taking that embryo, implanting it before her cycle, you know, at a certain point in her cycle so that she passes the egg with her period. It's like, We're at this point where we're highly complicating something.
It's crazy,
right? If we
right?
had more information, we could just it could be a little more simple.
Wow, I didn't know that. Wow, that's really, really shocking. And the other thing is, it's such a good part of the whole story that I believe often gets neglected, you know, the emotional and spiritual component of
right.
it, when you freeze your eggs or maybe even have an embryo somewhere, that there's
right.
a part of you, as you said, living somewhere, but you can't touch it or it will not enter your life, but you know it is somewhere. And
yeah,
just looking at that picture, it's like it must be so, so conflicting.
It's very conflicting for some women, and some women say, no problem, storage is done, you know, donate them, discard them. But some women I know have just had them in storage and they're well into their, you know, late 40s. They don't plan to have any more children and they're just sitting there paying rent.
Okay. Wow. So thank you for giving these three pillars of what's causing this fertility crisis. Of course, there are much more details to it. Just
Right.
one question. When you were talking about diet, nutrition, malnourishment, do you see that vegans, that it's harder for them to get pregnant because of
Yes,
the animal protein?
it is harder for them to get pregnant and then ultimately sustain the pregnancy. So I do see a higher instance of miscarriage and preterm birth with my plant-based clients and students. And a friend and colleague of mine, Lily Nichols, she wrote a great book. I actually was just chatting with her yesterday. She wrote three great books, and one of them is Real Food for Fertility. And it goes a little bit more deeply into that. So, you know, if a woman, you know, I know that for ethical reasons, many people choose to be plant-based or vegetarian. However, at that, the cost there is that it will greatly impact their own health when wanting to get pregnant, sustain a pregnancy, and then go on to breastfeed. And so, you know, we are omnivores, and I know that the meat and dairy industry is horrific in many aspects. So I can understand the desire. I was at one point in my life raw vegan, and it worked in the beginning because my body was disburdened from the inflammatory foods that I was eating. And it was almost like this detox, and I felt elated and I looked great. And then after about 18 months, I started to notice that I was becoming quite depleted and trying to get what I needed in the levels that I needed, especially for someone who was quite athletic. I couldn't do it. You know, there are very few people who are able to meet the requirements that the body actually needs through those types of diets. And even then, there are many components that one can only get through shellfish and organ meat and raw dairy. And so, yeah, I mean, and the vegetarian in the 90s was very different than the vegetarian now. You know, they were actually eating lots of eggs, and they were consuming, you know, certain products that were byproduct, you know, marine byproducts and things like that. And now it's like egg replacements, lots of nuts, almond milk and things like that, rather than actually drinking whole raw milk. As a vegetarian, which is part of the plan, they would drink whole raw milk, things like that. Now it's like almond milk, oat milk, highly inflammatory substances, creating these markers in the body, which then there's a huge link. There's some great studies out there. My friend, Dr. Kelly Brogan, wrote a great blog. I'll share it with you if you'd like to put it in the
yes,
show notes.
Please.
These inflammatory markers are one of the leading causes of postpartum depression. And so many women and men don't realize that they're eating foods that are causing inflammation in the body, and then go on to have, you know, these experiences that are quite surprising, like postpartum depression after birth. So it's not impossible for someone who's vegetarian or plant-based to get pregnant. However, they may run into complications with sustaining the pregnancy and having an easeful postpartum experience.
Thank you for that. And I just want to add something for those listening who maybe struggle with the idea of, I don't know, eating meat or drinking milk, or, I mean, yes, make sure that it's well sourced, you know, that it's not from mass industry. But I believe that we can and maybe have to go through changes within our diet, you know, what we eat through our lives. And I've been a vegetarian, then I haven't been, then I have been again, then I haven't, and now I'm like in a middle phase, but I myself went through a pretty radical dietary change 12 years ago, and that really opened so much up. And I stick to some of the things, but then with others, it has changed, and I feel your body changes, right? So why shouldn't your diet change to adapt to your needs?
It's a matter of also eating intuitively. We have so many of us say, I don't, no, I'm done. I don't want to feel full because I'll feel sick. That's because we're so used to eating poor quality foods that when we get full, we get other symptoms of feeling unwell, reflux, heartburn, headaches, sluggishness. However, when you're eating high quality fat and protein and you get satiated or full, you actually feel really good. So we don't know what it's like to feel satiated because we've been eating such poor quality foods for so long that are not compatible with our system that we just have no idea. So it's a matter of starting to pay attention, creating more slowness when we do eat so that we notice, oh, I ate oatmeal or muesli in the morning, and then I had a crash 2 hours later and I needed a coffee, right? So it's like, okay, that's obviously not working because there was no fat or protein involved, and maybe you had it with almond milk. So, of course, you're having a crash at 10 a.m. So if you just had a piece of bacon and an egg with your coffee, you would be satiated until lunchtime, and then you'd have more protein, And so protein is just so clean. And and of course we're all recovering from those days of the fat-free trend where they took fat out of everything, at least in North America they did. There's
Yeah, I went through the phase in my teens and early 20s.
yes yeah and it's like fat-free. And so what happened when we took the fat out of everything, it tasted horrible. So then the sugar industry was like, great, here's an opportunity, and their profits skyrocketed, and so did diabetes, and so did so many other health issues and obesity. So we require that fat for our hormones to properly function and for things to taste good. So we have to unlearn the cholesterol scare. We need egg yolks. We need at least six of them a day. But now it's like, don't just eat the egg whites. It's just so we have to unlearn and relearn a little bit. And like you said, we change. The way we eat will change. The way I eat in the winter is very different from the way that I eat in the summer. So we are seasonal creatures, right? We always have been.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, six egg yolks. I didn't know that. Oh, good. Which, well, when you just talked about breakfast, it's exactly the experience that I've made. So I had porridge or maybe just oats and something, some rice milk probably over it. And it would almost immediately afterwards, I would get sleepy and I was like, oh my gosh, I can't do that anymore. And then, like eating other things, I figured out, okay, if I put protein and fat in my breakfast, then I feel fuller for longer and I have more energy. And I also follow Kelly Brogan. I know you are friends, and I've done the KB smoothie, a little bit tweaked, but that was the inspiration in the beginning. So I put peanut butter and an egg, and it's just maybe some linseed, and it's just full of protein and
What did
fat.
you
And
notice?
that I feel more clear, I feel more energized, I don't get hungry that fast again. So it's really fueling me until lunchtime.
Totally. And you're getting necessary compounds that you need for the body to operate.
I'll link to the smoothie here as well in the show notes then. So just coming back to that you can get pregnant after 35 or 40. I mean, who really When did this narrative that we can't started? Was that big pharma that put that narrative out into the world, or?
Yeah, it's hard to say when, like what decade maybe to pinpoint which decade or which year the narrative really got blasted out that we are going to have a hard time after a certain age getting pregnant. I mean, miscarriage and the disappointment of, infertility has been around from the beginning. I mean, like it's recorded by Hippocrates, that a woman attempted and, didn't and had to try again, So it's not that it didn't exist until recent times and it's totally fabricated, but this thing with the age is where it's different because I think maybe in the last, don't know, maybe when I'd say Rockefeller medicine started to take hold of birth is when we could probably say that women started believing that it was going to be harder later. Because there was an idea that birthing when you were older was harder. You should do it when you're younger, but I don't even agree with that either. I've been with women in their early 20s who have challenging births, and I've been a doula with women in their 40s who have home births, and it's so easeful for them. So I don't personally believe that, but I feel that that's just kind of where it started. And of course, it benefits a whole industry to just kind of put it out there, And all it takes is just a few women sharing information, and then things spread like wildfire. So, yeah, so I would say it was probably in the last 100 years, that we really started believing that. I mean, there was always superstition around fertility, right? Every culture historically had some sort of, if you hang this in your doorway, the baby will come more easily, or if you drink this tincture, XYZ, but the way that we look at it now is so, so different. And I mean, my husband is from Yemen, and his mother gave birth, I think, to her eighth child when she was 48. He just said, "Oh, it's just women in the village. That's just what happens. Like, you just keep birthing until you don't." Like, and it, like for
That's
him,
so
it's so matter of fact. Like, there's no, but I was like, that's, you just birth until you don't. And so I always appreciated that perspective. And it's true, but also they're in a village where they're not constantly bombarded with propaganda on how their body functions and doesn't function based on what the experts say, So it's also it's like, again, it comes back to the exposure of that forms the belief system, the exposure to this information that forms, like, just read 1984 by George Orwell, and it's like, it makes sense. We start to form our reality based on whatever information we're getting fed.
So what's a good point to start to help women shift that narrative? Or break it in a way so that because we were talking about, or you said, okay, there's actually studies out there when we look at female mammals, there is no stop in production of eggs. They keep on being produced, maybe not in that amount as they were in our 20s, but they're still being produced. So is there a book or an article that women could read to help them ingrain that fact into their minds and belief systems.
Yeah, I'll share some of the studies with you. They're quite old, and like I said, a lot of them, you'll see a series of studies and then they lose funding after a certain time because I think that, again, it would benefit so many industries if they could control the way women conceive and birth, because it's literally the biggest pain point that a woman has in her lifetime. Like, generally speaking, the two biggest pain points are finding a partner and birthing a baby. And so if that can be monopolized and controlled, then you have pretty much every woman in your pocket. So it wouldn't really benefit women and the public, or it wouldn't benefit these industries and the public to have access to easy information to reverse a belief system, to unlearn and relearn this. So I will certainly share those articles, but I would really say it would come down to more of a personal exercise of a woman kind of doing her deepest fear inventory. Like, what would it mean if this weren't true? Like, what would it mean for me if it weren't true that I'm too old? it would mean that this is still possible for me. And it would mean that I'd have to face the fact I'm not partnered, for example. And then it would mean I would have to explore why I'm not partnered. And then it would mean I'd have to look at myself. And then it would mean I'd have to reflect on my own pain. And then it would mean I would have to heal wounds that keep me from being in partnership. So if we start to reverse engineer the belief system as to why we want to believe we're too old to get pregnant, it would come back to something much deeper that might be quite painful to extract and analyze. So I'd say finding other women who, you know, communing with other women who don't share these limiting beliefs, it would be a matter of reflecting, getting down to the core. Sometimes we need support with doing that. And I know it's hard because most people who offer coaching and support also believe that women get too old to birth. So it's not easy to find the resources. I'm always available. I'd love to help women reframe their ideas, but I would say kind of doing a deepest fear inventory about why. Why does it benefit you to believe this? And who really told you, and what was the proof? Just because you know a lot of people getting IVF, it doesn't mean that it's true. Because there are a lot of avenues that people who subscribe to IVF have not explored. They've not explored their belief system. They've not explored nutrition. When men are told that they have issues with their sperm quality, they're given pharmaceuticals and they're not ever talked, they don't talk about how to change the male diet, how to change lifestyle, how to stop disrupting their endocrine system with colognes and body products. No one talks to men about that. They're just given like a one-stop solution. So why would this industry teach you how to heal yourself when it would put them out of business or it would take a customer away? And this isn't to say that there isn't a small percentage of women and couples who do have actual true challenges with this, but the percentage is much smaller than we know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you. So insightful. And yes, I'm a true believer as well that if we just went back to more natural solutions, so many things would radically shift.
Yeah.
Because the simplest, the better most of the time. So
Right. Ditch
your toxic skincare, your cosmetics, take something that's natural, put oil on your face instead of some perfumed creams or whatever that is that you're buying.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's really, we're all so susceptible to marketing. I mean, from an early age, you know, and that's what it is. It's like, here's your pain point and I have the solution. So it's like just learning to be a more discerning consumer. I would say that's if you're asking for steps, learning to be a more discerning consumer. When I'm giving information, what pain point is it activating and what solution is being given to me? And do I believe them? Do I want to believe them? And how can I resolve this on my own without buying their product? You know? So those are just some questions to reflect on.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thank you. That's really good to start there. Now diving into our other topic, what has changed with birth in the last 150 years? Because
Right. When
we look at birth today, and I mean the way I was raised and observing how people were giving birth, I was always told, well, you have to go to the hospital to get your child, right?
Right.
And that was the reality for me. And then at some point, I don't know when, there was like, oh, there's this concept of home birth. You can have your baby at home. And in the beginning, I was like, oh my gosh, that must be dangerous. So, and I think that's the reaction of a lot of women and men out there, right? So,
Yeah. But
it's a natural process. So how did we get here? How did we get so confused?
So like in the 1880s was when the male physician, mostly in Western Europe and England, and then in New York and in the States, was the male physician began to make appearances at home births because women were still birthing at home with midwives, but then they came into the mix because they were, you know, they had this degree, they had this new thing that suddenly, you know, because until then, apothecaries, healers, even men who ran pharmacies throughout Europe, they were more alchemists. They were working with homeopathy and tinctures and natural medicine. And then, like I said, Rockefeller Medicine came in. There were a few people in different points throughout Europe and the US that were saying, we're going to create a club and we're going to decide, just kind of, we're just going to band together, create a club, and we're going to decide who gets to practice what we're going to call medicine and who doesn't. And if they don't go to our schools and if they don't meet our standards, then they will get sued, jailed, made to disappear. So they have to practice like us in order to be able to do this. So they just kind of decided. It wasn't like they were voted in and suddenly everyone's like, yes, by this, you know, majority vote, we want this person rule this group of, you know, males ruling medicine and health. No one decided that. They just had enough money and resources and pulled together. It's just like creating any old club. And so male physicians started going to birth, but they didn't have any experience in birth. They were learning about female anatomy from cadavers and from illustrations in books. They had no concept because they didn't personally have any female anatomy, and they didn't grow up watching birth like all the midwives had throughout the world. Every culture, every nook and cranny of our earth had midwives because everybody was giving birth everywhere. That's how society has sustained itself. And so these women would learn about birth from their mothers and then their mothers. It was passed down in a family tradition. So if it wasn't called a midwife, it was a medicine woman or the healer in the community. They were the ones who would attend the births. So this was all knowledge passed down for centuries and centuries and centuries. And so people in more high society said, oh, you know, this new thing, doctors, physicians, they have a degree, they go to school, and, you know, we want them at our birth. And then Queen Victoria decided to use chloroform during one of her births to ease the labor pains. And suddenly using drugs at birth became really popular. And so there were even feminists in New York City at the turn of the century who were forming, they formed this organization where they wanted all women to be able to have general anesthesia for birth because they said, we should be able to decide how our babies are born. And why should we as women have to suffer when men don't have to suffer for the family? And so they thought that by removing a woman's consciousness from the birth experience and removing any sense of pain, she was more empowered. So this was happening in Europe, this was happening in New York, and we started just to see this darkness enter the space of birth, where birth was placed kind of just like an object within the medical scientific rhetoric, whereas birth is actually just a natural symptom of being a human. Pregnancy is just a symptom of sexual intercourse, and birth is just a byproduct of the pregnancy. It's just something the body does. But now that it's been inside of this framework of science and emergency and medicine, we look at it as this thing that is inherently dangerous that we need to manage so that it stays safe. So a lot of people now, right, I'll rewind a little bit. A lot of people at that time started feeling more connected to the idea of having a physician because they just had tools, they had technology, they had forceps, they had different things, they had drugs. And then hospitals started building out all of these, you know, birthing wings and departments. And so they said, oh, now we have a regular customer, right? Women are giving birth every day. Not everyone's having, you know, breaking a leg every day. So we can't count on that for a profit at our hospital, but we can count on women birthing. And so then women were, okay, this is great. I can go to the birth. I live in an apartment in, you know, some part of London with my six kids. I don't want to give birth at home. I can go to this hospital and I can have people taking care of me and I can get drugs and then they can feed my baby with formula and I don't have to worry about breastfeeding. And eventually women just started to phase out of the home birth space for various reasons. And what started happening was a lot more babies were in trouble. Just because women were birthing in hospitals, we didn't see a greater, like a drop in fetal mortality. We actually did see a drop in maternal mortality because women were not hemorrhaging as much after birth. But it's not because women were hemorrhaging due to home birth. Women were hemorrhaging because midwives were slowly being phased out. So there was just this really challenging period where women didn't have comprehensive care and support from midwives in the community. And so they started sometimes birthing alone. They were in cramped quarters, no running water. They were in the city, and they were not supposed to be really birthing in cramped quarters in a city. They were supposed to be out in their villages with space and clean air and clean water and birthing there. But then when they started birthing in the cities at home, out of a hospital, a lot of women were dying. So birthing in the hospital did kind of lower the maternal mortality. However, we still saw babies in trouble, especially with the introduction of drugs into the process. We were seeing babies pulled out with forceps, having neck and head injury because of the forceps. Women were breastfeeding much less. So we started to see a lot of things decline for the worse, but women were alive, And so now, fast forward, 99% of women in North America birth in hospitals. 68% of women are having C-sections, whether elected or emergency oriented, or, and so if birth is really safer in a hospital, why are we having so many C-sections? Why are we having so many interventions? And why are we having so many babies in the NICU, right? In the neonatal intensive care unit? Like, that's what I'm wondering. And so our definition of safety now is they came out alive. They're alive. And that's not my definition of safety. My definition of safety is a woman and a baby are not violated. They're not physically violated or spiritually violated. They're not given drugs that have a lot of side effects. They're not given interventions that have a lot of side effects for mother and baby. That for me creates a lot of danger. And so I think generally speaking, we feel we're safer at the hospital and that home birth is dangerous because we have tools in a hospital to keep people alive. It's nuanced, right? Because I would feel much safer in a space where I'm not with strangers. I don't have access to dangerous drugs. And, there's not disease all around me, right? If we believe in that, if we believe that we can catch disease from doorknobs and touching things, hospital is not necessarily the cleanest place to be. So.
I love that you're mentioning that. Yes, it's true. I've written down a quote from you in this context, and it says, if we don't know our options, we don't have any. And I think that's so true, if we only think, or if we think that birthing at a hospital is the only option, then of course we do that because we don't know that there are other options.
Yeah, there are a lot of options. And, unfortunately, midwives, wherever you go, are so highly regulated by the government and policy that they feel like they're between a rock and a hard spot, So even some women say, oh, midwives are just like the OBs. They're insensitive. They're not empathic. They just are trying to protect themselves. And I say, yeah, unfortunately, midwives have been put in that place where they have to pay exorbitant fees for malpractice insurance that they can't even afford in their modest practices. And if they even misstep once, they'll get their license taken away. I've seen doctors do things when I've been at births. I've seen babies born alive and then die because of certain decisions doctors made, and they don't get out of practice. They might take a sabbatical, but they have the insurance and the backing to not lose their license. So, midwives are unfortunately under the microscope. And so it is hard to find a midwife, but it's also hard to find women who accept responsibility for their experience. And I want everyone to know, nobody is responsible for your experience. Not the doctor, not the nurses, not the hospital, and not the midwife, not the doula, nobody. These are all your choices to be made. And if something doesn't go the way you want it to, you have to go backward and say, where did I make a choice along the way that put me in this position? Right? That going to a hospital, it's the luck of the draw. You don't know which nurse you're going to get. You don't even know if it's your doctor that you've built a relationship with who's going to be there. So if you land with a doctor or nurses that don't treat you well, and then you say, oh, it's not their fault. It's actually your fault for choosing to birth in a place where this is totally possible for you to land with strangers. you
Yeah,
know, choosing
that's such a
not
good
to
point.
do childbirth education. So many people say, oh, you know, I'm young, I'm healthy, and you know what, how complicated is birth? I can just show up to the hospital, they'll tell me what to do, and it'll be fine. Chances are, most of the time, it doesn't go fine. You have to learn about this process. So it's your responsibility to educate yourself on birth. And watching birth in movies is not birth education. Hearing stories from friends is not birth education. So it's really on the couple and the woman to learn about this process, whether she's home birthing, whether she's hospital birthing, or going to a birth center.
You offer different courses and classes. Of course, you have also one-on-one consulting. Is there a course people could take, start somewhere? I think you have something on the educational birth, so
Yeah, I have a 90-minute master class. It's called Sovereign Birth, and just learn the basics of what your options are in the birth space. And if you want to go deeper, then we have an 8-module birth foundations course that's for men and women. So it's for the couple. If the woman is not partnered, she can take that class with her kind of partner of choice who's going to be with her through the pregnancy and birth process. And they learn to work together so that it's a very empowered experience. So much of the class is learning informed consent, learning what is different types of interventions, what are real emergencies, how what you do in the birth impacts your breastfeeding journey. So we really illustrate how the web was woven. We also have a class coming out that's just for men. It's coming out in about 5 weeks, so around mid-November, it'll be available, and it's just a 90-minute master class. It's free, and it's for men. How to really step into their role as well, what that looks like, and it might be surprising because I think women put a type of pressure and expectation on men, and it's really not their responsibility to do what the woman is expecting, but it's because she doesn't have appropriate female support. So she puts a lot of pressure on her partner, and it's not his occasion to rise to, so to speak. But we could talk more, we'll talk more about that in the master class. So yeah, there is definitely a few offerings. People just kind of dipping their toes, wanting to learn a little more. Maybe they have a child who's giving birth to their grandchild, or maybe they have a sister who's about to give birth. You just want to have a little bit more clear perspective. Yeah, we have kind of small to large scale offerings for anyone who's looking. So that can be found at uncoveringbirth.com.
Perfect. I'll link to that in the show notes. And I think that's very valuable what you just said, mentioning that birthing partner. If you don't have a partner, you want someone in your life who's with you throughout that process. And
Yeah.
I don't know, but I have the feeling that this is something that's often neglected or just not thought of.
Yeah, it's not.
And it's crucial, right? Just talking about it, it's like, okay, yeah, it's obvious. You have to have someone on your at your side who's with you through the whole process.
Right. And it could even be your sister, or maybe it's your mother, or if you have a doula, you know, just to have that support person. Women are not, you know, meant to birth alone in a vacuum. It is a very personal rite of passage, but it's not an isolated experience where a woman should be isolated and secluded emotionally or physically from a support person. Yeah.
And just talking about all this, I mean, this is, now looking at birth and getting pregnant, but it's really about so A, this self or sovereignty aspect is really popping up. You have to be self-responsible. You
Yeah.
have to empower yourself and take responsibility, and not just in the case of getting pregnant and birthing, but in every area of your life. You don't want to blindly trust the experts, here in air
Right.
quotes. And then the other thing is community. I think it's so crucial to always have that in mind, that we're not meant to do things on our own, but our society is often so geared towards that. And in
Yeah.
our day and age, with all the technology and being connected online, but it's not the same.
No, everyone's connected online and everyone, for the most part, feels isolated and sad.
Yeah.
We are wired for connection as humans. You know, we're not like cats where we go out and we're, you know, alone, you know, and we can survive alone and we don't need the co-regulation. We are wired for connection with our children, with our partners, with community. And I think at this point, so many people don't even know what that feels like. It's hard to even know how to get it because we don't know what it feels like. And so, yeah, it's the online community is a false sense of connection. I really do believe it kind of satisfies one element of it, but ultimately it's not the day to day of knowing, you know, that there's support around the corner or that we're going to share a meal together. Or if something happens with the weather, we can come together and help each other. You know, that doesn't exist with an online community. So it has its benefits, but it's not what I'm talking about here, that authentic in-person connection.
Yeah. Thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Oh, I think we've left everyone with a lot to chew on, pun intended. So no, but I'm just really grateful to have spent this time with you. So thank you for creating that opportunity to connect. And yeah, this has been wonderful.
Sure. Thank you for being here. And I believe when we chatted before we started the recording, you have also a masterclass coming up, right?
Yeah.
Was it that one that you mentioned or is, no, it's a different one.
Oh, a different one. So this masterclass is coming up in mid-October. It's understanding postpartum depression and how to prevent it and what really causes postpartum depression. So this is a free masterclass. If you know anyone who's experienced it or you've experienced it yourself, it'll just be really great to have you there. There will be a Q&A at the end. So whatever questions come up, I'll be there to have the conversation. And then if anyone's interested in birth work, we Uncovering Birth has an extensive doula training. So it's a 5-month program and it's really a lot of fun, really powerful container. And that'll be starting in January 2025.
Wow, very good. Thank you. Yeah, it must be so empowering, really. I mean, all of what I've heard from you, of you so far, it's just super empowering. And I love that there are people like you out there breaking those narratives that we have been told. And actually, this has been part of the mission of my podcast from the beginning in different areas, in not living the standard 9-to-5, but also telling people, well, if you actually have options, you don't have to be in that rat race every day. You can quit your job. You can do something different. You don't have to work 5 days a week. So I started this off with my Freedom Lifestyle series, and now I'm diving into different aspects of this, self-empowering of self. So yeah, thank you for
it's a journey.
All that you do.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thanks so much again.
Thanks so much for listening. I really hope that you enjoyed this episode, that you got some good wisdom out of it. Whatever it was, there were any aha moments for you, anything that was particularly helpful, please let us know. Leave us a comment over on Instagram where I'll be posting some snippets of this conversation, or send us a message. We're really happy to hear from you. And well, now enjoy your day or your evening, and I'll hope to see you on the next one.